Well, are you an incurable romantic? Hopefully you don't take that too far. Frank Tallis is a clinical psychologist who taught the subject at the Institute of Psychiatry and Neuroscience at King's College in London. He's the author of 15 books, including The Incurable Romantic and Other Tales of Madness and Desire. Frank Tallis, thank you for joining us and welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hello.
Well, this is a fascinating book, and when you first get into it, it almost reads like a collection of short stories. These are individuals that you have worked with in your practice. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I actually got into the subject of lovesickness through obsession. I was originally seeing patients who were suffering from obsessive-compulsive disorder and just became generally interested in the subject of obsession. And I eventually wrote a book called Lovesick, which was a kind of history of lovesickness, and started to get more and more referrals to do with lovesickness and, I suppose, what might be broadly described as conditions of longing and desire.
And we believe, erroneously, I guess, that there's one true love out there for us. And actually, there's probably a whole lot of people that could fit the bill just fine, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the basic beliefs that we get with, I suppose, the myth and the legend surrounding romantic love. I mean, it's quite interesting if one looks at, why we actually believe in romantic love and where these beliefs come from. I mean, if you actually trace the history of romanticism, it goes right back to early Middle Eastern literature and allegorical works, which actually describe the soul's yearning for union with God. And this is usually represented by a man yearning for a beautiful woman. Now, this idea has been absorbed into Western culture, but it's no longer understood as an allegory. And that's proved very problematic. There are high expectations for romance to deliver, let's say, heavenly union and paradise on earth. And, needless to say, such high expectations often lead to disappointment. And so I suppose what we believe in terms of romanticism is a quest for a kind of spiritual perfection in the material world. And it just simply doesn't deliver that. And we often get very disappointed. I mean, there are lots of, I suppose, unhelpful beliefs underpinning romantic love. The idea that one's partner should be beautiful and perfect, there's a kind of idealization there. The idea that, love is fated, there's only one person who we're destined to meet, and only one person who can make us happy. The idea even that love must be tormented to be real, that, in a sense, obstacles are put there in the way sometimes to test us, to give it deeper meaning. So, in a way, the whole romantic belief system is somewhat confused and often leads to disappointment and unhappiness.
Are these unrealistic ideas that we have about romantic love something that we learn in childhood? Are they culturally based? Do we see quite different scenarios played out in different parts of the world?
Well, in terms of Western culture, I mean, our culture is absolutely saturated with romanticism, and it just goes unquestioned. So, the idea that someone might die for love, if it's actually depicted in a movie, we never question it. We always want things to resolve in terms of the narratives we enjoy, happily and romantically. And so, yes, I mean, we live in a culture that is utterly saturated with romantic beliefs. And, of course, we celebrate that in terms of things like Valentine's Day. It's something that's very much a part of us in our belief system.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the stories that you have in the book. They're pretty amazing. Excuse me. The very first one that you have is called The Barrister's Clerk, and it's about a woman named Megan who goes to see her dentist, and things go horribly wrong from there. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, I mean, this was a very interesting case because this woman was very, very sweet-natured. She was happily married for 20 years, had no really significant history of psychiatric problems. She had a complicated extraction and fell in love with her dentist. There was no reason. She, he he never gave her any reason to fall in love with him. It was just a kind of automatic thing. Now, the problem was that she couldn't accept that that love was not reciprocated. And she ended up with a diagnosis of de Clairenbeau syndrome. And de Clairenbeau syndrome is really a kind of a delusion of love. Now, we all fall in love. That happens all the time. But often we accept limits. We accept that not everybody will fall in love with us. Now, unfortunately, with de Clairenbeau syndrome, what happens is that the person who's affected by this condition actually believes that the person who they have fallen in love with has actually fallen in love with them too, but is in a kind of state of denial. And so they take it upon themselves to try to get that person to recognize that they're in a state of denial. And this results in stalking, various forms of harassment. And obviously the situations can become very troubled as a result of that.
Is this something that happened to her very quickly, or did it sort of evolve over a period of time?
Well, the extraordinary thing about de Clairenbeau syndrome is that it can come right out of the blue. You know, it's lightning from a clear blue sky. Someone can be, leading a very, very sort of ordinary and uneventful life, can be relatively stable emotionally, and suddenly it can happen. I mean, this was actually the most extraordinary fact about this particular case. I mean, because she was so, in quotation marks, normal. She was so grounded ordinarily, and yet suddenly she was passionately in love, and she dramatized all of those kind of romantic ideals. You know, she began to believe that she was almost like in spiritual contact with her dentist, that she knew his thoughts. And one very much got a sense that, this is where love crosses the line and goes into a sort of, delusional domain.
We're speaking this morning with Frank Tallis. He's a clinical psychologist. He's written a fascinating new book called The Incurable Romantic and Other Tales of Madness and Desire. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with your questions and more with our interview with Mr. Tallis right after this. We're speaking today with Frank Tallis, a clinical psychologist and the author of the new book, The Incurable Romantic and Other Tales of Madness and Desire. I was thinking about how stalking used to involve getting up off your chair and going out and actually doing that. And I know that this lady that you were speaking of that became infatuated with her dentist did that. But, of course, we live in the modern age of social media. That raises stalking to a whole new level, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, in a way, what social media has done is actually underscored that when we fall in love, we really do flirt with madness, because so many people now engage in cyberstalking. I mean, it was once regarded as being indicative of having a profound problem like de Clairenbeau syndrome, or being evidence of some kind of profound psychological disturbance. And yet, maybe all of the old psychiatry books were wrong, and that, in fact, our predisposition to stalk is much, much more strong than we had previously thought, because certainly social media and the internet have revealed a whole capacity for stalking that we really didn't recognize before.
Is it harmless to get on social media and check up on the life of a former lover? I mean, at what point does it get to be out of control?
I don't think in itself checking up on a former lover is a problem, because former lovers are special to us. We've had a strong emotional bond with them. Also, in a sense, our histories are quite important. Our relationships are quite important in terms of us understanding our personal histories. In a way, when you put a name into Google and search for the name of an ex-lover and find out where they are, in a way, you're wanting to really answer questions about yourself and where you are and how far you've come in life. So I don't think it's automatically a negative thing. But obviously, if it becomes compulsive, if it becomes something that you can't stop doing, if it's done to, I suppose, reduce a feeling of discomfort, so it has an obsessional quality, then perhaps I think it has become a problem.
We are talking today about the book, The Incurable Romantic and Other Tales of Madness and Desire. If you'd like to join the conversation, have a question about the madness of falling in love or any issues surrounding that, you can give us a call at 800-838-3760 or send us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at The Jeff Exchange. One of the stories that you have, I think it's the second one in your book, it talks about a man who has a very successful career, a business, a family business, quite wealthy, and he spends basically himself to the point of bankruptcy or close to it on prostitutes and hiding this from his wife, trying to find some kind of validation from, I guess, that. Can you describe that story for us?
Yeah, this was an extraordinary story. I was referred this man for treatment because his wife had discovered that he had seen a prostitute, and she decided that she would, continue in the relationship if he sought some kind of treatment. After a few sessions, he confessed that he hadn't seen one prostitute, but in fact he had seen somewhere in the region of 3,000 prostitutes. And not only that, that he had pretty much bankrupted his family business on prostitution. When I actually inquired further as to what was actually happening, it seemed that, because I thought that he, it was perhaps a form of sex addiction, but it was actually far more interesting than sex addiction. What he would do typically was that he would find a prostitute who he found attractive. He would then wine and dine that woman, take her out, shower gifts upon her. He would then, encourage her to have fantasies about the life they might lead together in love and perfectly happy. They would go and view large houses together and plan a future. And at the point where the woman actually turned around and said to him, "I love you," he would then disappear. He was actually not addicted to sex. He was addicted to the rituals of courtship. And he was addicted to the feeling of being fallen in love with. So it was quite a subtle case, because it presented as some kind of very out-of-control sex addiction. But in fact, it was a love addiction, and even in a more refined way, just an addiction to being fallen in love with. And he did, in fact, bankrupt a family business with all of the sort of showering of gifts and all of this courting. And it was an extraordinary and, of course, a very sad and tragic story.
I'm wondering, because some of the stories that you share in your book are so unusual, are there treatment protocols, or are you in completely new territory in trying to work with your patients?
Well, I think there are treatment protocols in the sense that, any psychotherapist has a set of techniques, a set of theoretical frameworks that they can apply to problems. So you're not completely out there. You're not completely without anything that you can do. However, I think these problems are perhaps more challenging clinically because they haven't been taken seriously for so long. I mean, it's quite interesting. In a way, we've gone backwards as a culture medically. lovesickness and conditions of longing and desire were recognized by doctors from classical times until the 18th and early 19th centuries. So it's only recently that the idea of lovesickness has lost currency as a clinical diagnosis. We've always recognized that, you know, when love is healthy, it isn't always an entirely happy condition. So it's associated with symptoms that do overlap with mental illness, melancholy, mood swings, obsession. But when love actually does go wrong, I mean, the psychological consequences can be very problematic indeed. You know, infatuation, jealousy, heartbreak, inappropriate attachment, sex addiction, you know, stalking, murder, suicide. I mean, these are very, very serious consequences. And in a way, we've lost something that was there in the classical world. I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, I studied, before I actually qualified as a clinical psychologist, I studied psychology for 8 years. And during that time, I only had 1 hour's teaching on what we would call romantic love. And it was taught in a way that was kind of jokey. It wasn't presented as a serious subject. And yet, you know, if you went back to, the medieval Islamic world, or you went back to classical Greece and spoke to a doctor, in a way, in theoretical terms, they'd have more to say about conditions of longing and desire than a contemporary clinician.
You mentioned in your writing that we have sex education in our schools, but we don't really have love education. What form would that take? How would you even approach doing love education?
Well, I think really a lot of work could be done explaining how, particularly for the young, love can be a very, very overwhelming experience. We have a very curious attitude to love when it happens with young people. We often belittle their experience, turn it into a joke, maybe are even slightly mocking about it. You know, we think it can't be serious. And yet, I mean, if you actually look at love and adolescence, the experience is very intense. We also make the wrong assumption that with adolescents and teenagers, physical and emotional maturity progress together. But sometimes they don't progress together at all. Sometimes there are big gaps in terms of the differences between physical maturity and emotional maturity. So an adolescent might be able to have an intimate relationship with someone, but then be completely unable to cope with the emotion that comes with, say, rejection. And there is a marked elevated risk of suicidal thoughts in teenagers, you know, particularly when they come out of relationships and they have been distressed by not being able to cope with the emotion. So, I mean, I think if one were to approach this logically in terms of, you know, a program of love education, it would be really just allowing kids and teenagers to recognize that it can be a very intense and overwhelming experience, to let them know that their experiences can be taken seriously by counselors and psychologists and psychotherapists, and that they can be helped through difficult emotional experiences.
What impact are we seeing from some of the modern tools on both teenagers and adults? I'm thinking of things like internet porn or sexting, which has become a big issue, especially with teenagers lately. What kind of impact is that having on these sorts of aberrant views of good romance and good sexual health?
Well, it's in a way, it's been quite catastrophic. When teenagers are interviewed, particularly with respect to internet pornography, they often feel quite frightened of sex because they believe that they are going to have to perform in a way that is consistent with what they see in pornographic representations of sex. It also makes them extremely body conscious. As a result of that, there are very, very high levels of dissatisfaction with how their bodies look. And that's related to depression, eating disorders, compulsive exercising, and addiction to muscle-building drugs. So these changes that we see that the internet is bringing about are not positive. One could say that in some respects the internet has been helpful. So one can look at something like, if you look at cultures where there are arranged marriages, couples are introduced, they get to know each other before they actually move on in any way to some kind of intimacy. And I suppose, in a way, certain dating apps and the internet provides something that is similar, in that people can get to know each other quite well before they actually meet and become intimate. And that might be more helpful in terms of cultivating more meaningful relationships. But overall, I think the evidence is that the modern world is not good for love and, I suppose, healthy attitudes in the young.
We are speaking today with Frank Tallis. He is the author of the book, The Incurable Romantic. Here's just a brief review from The Economist. Mr. Tallis is a gifted storyteller. In The Incurable Romantic, he applies a novelist skill to his clinical material. His characters remain sharply, painfully real, their stories as inconclusive, messy, and fascinating as life. I'd like to ask you a little bit, maybe it relates to what we were just talking about, but one of the stories that you have in here is about a young man that has perhaps too healthy amount of self-esteem about his own body. Can you describe that story?
This was a gay man that I saw who had, I suppose, in the end, got himself into the position where he'd fallen in love with himself. I mean, I call the chapter Narcissus, because he sort of kind of replicated the ancient Greek legend. But the core of the story is rather sad. I mean, he was a gay man who was brought up in a homophobic family. He was brought up in a culture that was quite hostile to the whole idea of being gay. And I suppose he internalized a lot of this prejudice, and he considered, I suppose, very, very deeply, being gay to be something that was, you know, dirty, disgusting, something that he couldn't quite come to terms with. Obviously, I tried to help him to do, you know, in terms of those views, in terms of, you know, challenging ideas that perhaps aren't very helpful for peace of mind. But these ideas that he had, this internalized sort of self-hate, was very, very deep, and it was an obstacle for him in terms of forming relationships with other gay men. And in a way, he ended up finding his ideal sexual partner in himself, in just sort of, I suppose, his sex life became reduced to the kind of small world of looking at himself and stimulating himself in a mirror. But as I say, he got there through a very sad path. He got there through this internalized disgust, and he claimed to be happy with this result, that in a way this was his particular sexual trajectory, and if it meant that, you know, he was, in a way, just having a relationship with himself, that was better than having to confront and to deal with the difficult emotions that having a relationship with another man tended to arouse in him.
There are a number of stories, of course, recently, tragic stories about sexual abuse that have existed in different contexts, including in some religious settings. Do you see that as playing into part of the problem that you've dealt with in counseling?
I guess, in terms of religious settings, I mean, the classical Freudian model is that what we try to repress always returns. What we try to deny always comes back in some way. So yes, I think it falls into the remit of psychotherapy and psychology. Psychology and psychotherapy have things to say about these kinds of phenomena. And I suppose that if one were to take a traditional psychoanalytic perspective, one would say that it's a very, very particular and special person who can deny and repress something that is so much a part of being human and expect to be able to go through life without experiencing some kind of perhaps negative psychological consequence.
I have a few questions I'd like to pursue about some of the darker side of this that leads to suicide and violence. I think I'll wait to ask those after the break in a minute or so. But for people who are really trying to find a healthier model, they can really benefit from therapy. What kind of resources are available?
Well, psychotherapy is a very, very broad church indeed. There are many different approaches. Some people like a problem management approach, where one is just, learning skills, management skills for their various problems. And something like cognitive behavior therapy would be very, very effective and helpful. Other people like to go deeper. Other people like to have a greater understanding of how they've got to be the person they are. And if you like, they need to have more of a sense of narrative, more of a sense of how their past relates to their present. And more psychoanalytic approaches are perhaps preferable for those people. I always say that, to anybody who's looking for help within a psychotherapeutic context, to learn about it, to understand what's available. And, if you were buying a TV set, you'd, probably make a few inquiries, see what's available on the market, and then make a choice.
And
that applies exactly to psychotherapy.
We're speaking with Frank Tallis. More after the break. You can join our conversation this morning by calling 800-838-3760 or emailing us at jx@jeffnet.org. We're speaking with Frank Tallis, a clinical psychologist who taught the subject at the Institute of Psychiatry and Neuroscience at King's College in London. He's the author of 15 books, including the one we're talking about this morning, The Incurable Romantic and Other Tales of Madness and Desire. My question, again, regarding some of this dark side with suicide and violence, we laugh off the whole notion of lovesickness, but talk a little bit about the statistics we're seeing and if there's been an increase in this in recent years with violent episodes.
Well, certainly violence within relationships is a major problem and a rising problem. And it's almost always related to sexual jealousy. So about 10% of murders are murders within relationships. It's usually the man who kills the woman, but it does happen the other way around too. There are a certain number of cases where women kill men because of jealousy. But the predominant problem is male sexual jealousy, and it is associated with domestic violence that escalates and sadly frequently ends with murder. The justification that is often given at the end of that sad process is, if I can't have her, no one will have her. I mean, it's a curious sort of twisted way to think about the person who you are supposed to love, but it is a problem that is global as well. I mean, it isn't just the United States and Europe. You see it pretty much all over the world.
What are things that are being done these days to try to combat some of that violence?
Well, The only two things that you can do really, within the kind of medical and psychological realm, so outside of the social realm and outside of education, is that perhaps sometimes these problems are associated with a general level of mood disturbance. So you can offer people medication, and you can offer people forms of psychotherapy. But outside of those two particular channels, we don't have a great deal to offer. And there is an enormous role for educationalists to intervene and to make sure that, you know, people grow up with a clear idea of what to expect from relationships and a clear idea about how their emotions perhaps can be managed more profitably.
You have a chapter in your book entitled The American Evangelist. Talk a little bit about that story.
Yeah, this was a very curious event in my life. When I was considerably younger and it was more fashionable to drop out, I dropped out. Married young, had a child young, and was living in a very small village in the north of England. I'd got to know another young family, there was a mother with and a sister and two small children. And around this time, an American evangelist came to live in the north of England with a few of his disciples. And I later learned that he had been instructed by God to start a mission in this very, very small and remote village, which struck me as a very kind of strange thing for God to want at the time. It wasn't an obvious place that needed evangelism and his services. Anyway, to cut a long story short, he fell in love with this friend of mine who had these two kids, and they wanted to get married, but unfortunately, she was still in the process of divorce, and so it had to be postponed. And he had an enormous psychotic breakdown. One night, I was sitting in my cottage, and I was there was a knock on the door, and the sister came round and said, "Please come, because he's going to kill us all. He wants to sacrifice us all to God." And what had happened was that I suppose his sexual frustration had destabilized him again. It was a perfect example of love and sexual frustration destabilizing this person. And he did actually want to sacrifice this young family to God, because I suppose they could then all be unified in heaven. And I had to talk him down. I mean, unfortunately, there wasn't anybody around at the time to do that. And I had to kind of engage him and talk him down. Eventually, the police were called, and he was taken to hospital and treated. But it was a very frightening experience, because he really was in a very disturbed state. And his ultimate intention was to sacrifice the person he loved, the children, so they could be united in heaven and be together. And for me, my understanding of that then, as now, was that it was due to him having very little experience of falling in love, being destabilized by the experience of falling in love, and not being able to cope with his sexual frustration.
I'm wondering, we've talked a little bit about the component of people exerting power over other people to try to control their lives. And of course, this is manifested in pedophilia and in other situations. Are we seeing an increase in that? And how serious has that become as a global problem?
Well, I guess we're seeing more pedophilia now than ever before, because we recognize it more. I mean, it was thought to be something that was extremely rare, but now it is something that is more widely recognized, and I guess more people are coming forward for treatment, which is helpful. I mean, the case that I write about in the book, I have a chapter titled The Good Pedophile, which is an extremely unusual case of a paedophile who had never offended and said that he would never offend, and was extremely depressed because he realized that he would never be able to have a meaningful relationship with the object of his affection, which would be a young girl. And it was an extremely interesting case because he had a very, very clear sense of right and wrong. And he was pretty suicidal because he fully recognized that if he offended, he would potentially damage the object of his affection. And he couldn't actually do that. He was very unusual because many, many paedophiles are not conscientious. Many paedophiles are terribly manipulative and show a marked absence of conscience. And so he was an extremely interesting man to treat and to talk to.
You also have a story in there about self-deception, and that seems like, I believe it's the Night Porter story. And it seems like there's that's a big component in all of this, is people that suffer from mental illness associated with love sickness or whatever you want to call it. At some point in time, they start to engage in self-deception. Talk a little bit about that.
Oh, sure. In many respects, a lot of the conditions of longing and desire are semi-delusional. People believe things about themselves that are just simply untrue, and often they create goals, create things that they want to pursue, and in order to pursue those goals, they have to fundamentally deceive themselves. So a lot of these problems, a core feature is a lack of insight complemented by deception, which actually then leads to often very self-defeating behavior.
For someone who's on that slippery slope, are there things that individuals can do to check themselves to make sure that they're keeping their attitudes healthy?
I think people can read about these problems. People can learn about how these problems work. People can talk. I think talking and human contact is enormously important. You don't have to talk to a professional. Often just externalizing problems, just somehow just getting it out there in a social situation can be helpful. So talking to a close friend, talking to a member of one's family. People often inflate problems enormously by not talking about them, and they get completely exaggerated and cause, you know, tremendous problems as a result of that. So just talking. And of course, there is always the benefit of early intervention, if it looks like it's a serious problem and it's getting out of hand, of seeking professional help early. I mean, it's much easier to control a problem when it's in its early stages rather than wait until it's got completely out of control. And also the social consequences are easier to manage if you get there early.
We are speaking with Frank Tallis, a clinical psychologist who taught the subject at the Institute of Psychiatry and Neuroscience at King's College in London, the author of 15 books, including this one, The Incurable, Romantic, and Other Tales of Madness and Desire. If you'd like to join our conversation this morning, 800-838-3760, or as always, you can send us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. You write that successful relationships have a few simple ingredients. Let's talk about those.
Yeah, I mean, I was basing that comment on the work of Robert Sternberg, who was a researcher into love. And he really just asked the question, what is love? What is consummate love? What is the kind of love that is more durable? And makes people happy. And his research suggested that we can really talk about consummate love in terms of three components. There's passion. There has to be some reciprocated sexual interest. There is intimacy. You have to like the person who you're in love with, and right. They have to like you. There has to be a degree of being on the same wavelength. You know, ease of communication, and then finally there has to be mutual commitment. And if you have feelings of passion in a relationship, if you have feelings of intimacy and closeness, and there is mutual commitment, that's probably about as good as it gets.
You know, sexual attraction seems like something that's probably a little bit hard to engineer. But for folks who are in the early stages, or I guess at any point in their relationship, how do you develop a greater intimacy and commitment to one another?
Well, in terms of, I mean, naturally, as one gets older, I guess there's a shift in terms of emphasis from the sexual element of a relationship to intimacy. So, I mean, obviously, any relationship can have a sexual element that can last, until you're in your 80s. However, for fairly obvious reasons in terms of what happens to the human body as it gets older, your sex life in your 80s is not going to be the same as when you were maybe 18. There will naturally be, marked differences. What is a good prescription for the future and the durability of relationships is for the sexual component to be preserved as well as it can be, given the ravages of time, but also to have a strong emphasis on all of those other things that are to do with mutuality. So, intimacy beyond just physical contact. I mean, intimacy in terms of communication, intimacy in terms of shared interests, intimacy in terms of a shared social group. All of those things are very valuable in terms of the preservation of relationships, and commitment usually follows on naturally from that, that people want to be committed to each other because they are happy in those circumstances.
Perhaps it's my imagination, but it seems like commitment isn't what it used to be. Is there ways to develop that, separate from deepening intimacy between a couple?
Well, in my own practice and in my own view, I would not be in favor of any artificial forms of coercing commitment. I mean, what you're left with when that happens is people who are unhappy together but staying together because of a sense of duty, and it's a rather unhealthy way to proceed. I think commitment really should grow out of the other two elements that Sternberg identifies. I mean, I think that commitment should arise out of having a contented coming together of people who are happy both sexually and emotionally. The commitment will follow naturally.
We've been speaking with Frank Tallis, the author of the new book, Incurable Romantic and Other Tales of Madness and Desire. Mr. Tallis, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.